Welcome to Resolutions, the official podcast of the American Bar Association, Section of Dispute Resolution. Every episode is a journey into the heart of conflict resolution, guided by our diverse community of experts. We're here to explore innovative strategies, share wisdom from the field, and inspire excellence in resolving disputes. Whether you're a dispute resolution professional, a curious learner, or someone passionate about fostering understanding and peace, you're in the right place. Let's dive into today's conversation and discover how we can transform conflict into opportunity together.
I'm your host, Aaron Gotthelf. This week, I'm sitting with maritime attorney and American Arbitration Association panelist, Leroy Lambert, to discuss ADR in the aftermath of the Baltimore Bridge collapse. Leroy is president of the Society of Maritime Arbitrators, outside general counsel to the board of the American Steamship Owners Mutual Protection and Indemnity Association, and of counsel to the New York firm of Poles Tublin. He received his JD from Tulane and clerked for the Chief Justice of the Louisiana Supreme Court. Leroy spent 25 years in private practice at the maritime firms of Healy & Bailey and Blank Rome, and also served as general counsel for the U.S. representative of the Standard P&I Club. He is a proctor member of the Maritime Law Association and served on its board of directors from 2015 to 2018, and is a member of the American Arbitration Association Commercial Panel, the Houston Maritime Arbitrators Association, and the German Maritime Arbitration Association. Leroy is co-author of Voyage Charters, the leading treatise in the field of maritime law. Okay, folks, just like I've done in previous podcasts, going to give this disclaimer. Before we start, I wanted to give a quick disclaimer that we are not giving any legal advice, and Leroy will not be discussing anything beyond what has already been made public by various news agencies. Welcome, Leroy.
Thank you, Aaron, and thank you for the AAA and the AVA for giving me this opportunity. I look forward to a great conversation and discussion of these issues.
Fantastic. All right. So this horrible tragedy happened last week. A lot of folks saw it on the news and had lots of questions. People are already saying it's going to create many, many years of work for attorneys, as well as probably mediators and arbitrators and folks in the ADR profession, which are the folks that are primarily listening to this podcast. I learned a lot about the case just kind of reading through some of the various news agencies and how it's kind of a very specialized area of insurance. So the first thing I wanted to start with is, what is a P&I club and how will that situation apply here?
Yes, great. Thanks, Aaron. My own disclaimer is I don't intend to give any views, but to the extent I end up giving a view on something, it's my own. It's not for any organization
sure.
that I represent.
Absolutely.
The P&I is protection and indemnity, and you've got to take yourself back into a world where there were no commercial insurance companies. Shipping predates all of that. And at some point, ship owners, when they realized the risks that they were taking in sending a ship with cargo on board under the supervision and care and direction of a master, it could be wiped out and it would be months before they even heard about it. So over time, and thanks to other developments, which are happening in something called the Lloyd's of London, ship owners began to band together as a mutual insurance company to share the risks that they were all subject to in going about the business of operating ship in international commerce. And these were early on, of course, predominantly in England, and still the marine insurance hub. But so the first thing to remember is the owners of these P&I club, and they banded together, and that's why they are called clubs. Like you would say, okay, we're going to play tennis, or we're going to form a golf club, or whatever.
So they banded together to spread risk, essentially, right?
To spread risk.
How is this different than just like I said? I might be using the wrong terms here. Is this different than typical reinsurance, or are there reinsurers that insure the folks in the P&I club, the primary insurers?
There are above the risks that the P&I clubs take, and we can talk about that too. But the P&I clubs are their mutuals, and they generally, because they're ship owners, they then hire managers to run the insurance aspect of it. So over time, they develop rules, and the beauty of the system is the P&I, let me back up, There are now 12 P&I clubs, these mutual insurance clubs, in what is called the International Group of P&I Clubs. And it's generally stated that they insure 90% of the world's ocean-going ships. There are several which are quite large, there are some which are in the middle, and there are some which are small. But they pool those risks. So not only do you have the ship owners in a club pooling risk and sharing it, but the 12 clubs are pooling 90% of the risk incurred by ship owners and operators around the world. And then each club has the first 10 million, and then they share from 90 to 100 million. And then above 100 million, they go into the commercial market and buy reinsurance. But because they go in as a unit, they can achieve very favorable rates. And Brussels has done studies, because this looks like a cartel of some sort. But every study they've done, every 10 years or so, they conclude that the ultimate consumer of the goods that are shipped around the world, much less the ship owners, couldn't get a better deal if this was done on a for-profit basis. It's an amazing system, and it's worked well, and it's a credit to all the people involved. Above 100 million, then they buy an additional 2.1. It's actually more than that. They, for a casualty such as this, they purchase reinsurance up to $3 billion is available for such an incident.
Okay. Well, I guess that's some of the estimates that have come in, and that it's going to be somewhat in that range for the total damages. Now, I'm going to ask something that's very basic here. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm blessed to drive over the Golden Gate Bridge in the morning to commute to work and all that. And I like to look out the window and see all the big cargo ships going back and forth into the bay and leaving the bay. Do shipping companies typically own the vessels that the cargo containers sit on? Because I've noticed on a lot of these boats, the name on the actual vessel, the company name on the vessel, is very different than the name on the containers.
Actually, there's two questions. Okay. There's a variety of ways to do it. Let's talk about the container ships. I'm not talking about crude oil carriers
container ships like the ship that obviously hit the bridge of Baltimore.
So you have, at a certain level, you have very passive owners. These are people who banks or private equity or collections of wealthy people have put together because of, say, tax advantages for having a ship in their given jurisdiction, whether it's Japan, Greece, wherever. And so, but they're not really interested in running or operating a ship.
Right.
That's at one extreme. And so they charter that ship, they finance it, and it gets built, but they charter it out. And the charter is like lease, if you're used to real estate, think of charters. They charter it out to someone else to operate it, and who will then pay them money for in return for the opportunity for them to make money using the ship. Right. And the charter form is like the typical triple net lease in real estate. That's where the passive owner just says, it's all yours. You pay me a modest amount. That satisfies me, but you take on all the risk. That's likely not what's happening here, although it may be. The more typical arrangement is a ship owner enters into a charter party with somebody who says, I can make money using the ship because I know where the cargoes are. I know the ports. And that's called a time charter. You'll do it for a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. And in that case, sort of like the old dating myself TV show Paladin, Have Gun, Will Travel, the time charterer, the owner says, here, you pay for the fuel, you pay for the expenses incurred in the port that you direct the ship to, and I'll provide the crew and insurance and a ship. And we'll carry cargoes, lawful cargoes, wherever you want to go. You just keep paying for the fuel. And my crew will go anywhere you tell it to, or you say it's only going to go here. We don't agree that it'll go there. But that's the basic time charter. And that's what most of these container ships are. There's a third form, a voyage charter, which is for a particular voyage between two ports, to simplify. And there the owner takes on all the risk, including the fuel.
Okay, so in a situation, like I said, may not be specific to the Baltimore situation, but in situations where the passive owner of the ship has essentially leased the ship out to another operator, is the passive owner primarily indemnified for accidents of this type by that, or are they still on the hook for some incidents?
If it's the true bareboat charter, that's where they, under the terms of the charter agreement, they then, all of that responsibility is taken on by the bareboat charterer. Here, what, according to the reports I've read, is the case, is somewhat in between, where, and I don't know how involved the owners, Grace Ocean, I think, are as ship owners, but there's another company called Synergy been in the reports, and they're said to be the managers of the ship. And the managers of the ship can cover a range of things, commercial management, in which you're responsible for chartering it out, or just or crewing and technical maintenance. And that's done for a fee. And typically, those two entities, the owner and the managers, are on one certificate of insurance.
Okay.
Not always, but so there is a contractual arrangement with indemnities as between them, those two, but it's, again, I wouldn't expect in this case that to be the case. Now, on the ship, if you look at any container ship, you'll see Maersk, Hyundai, ONE, you'll see containers of every color and logo. Well, let me back up. So sometimes if Maersk or MSC, for example, or ONE, Hapag-Lloyd, if they're operating a ship and they have the right under the time charter to make it look like, appear to the world as a Maersk ship or a ONE ship. So they paint it their colors, they paint the funnel with their logo. This appears to be Dali. They didn't name it the Maersk Dali, which indicates it's just operating in Maersk service, because Maersk, MSC, Hyundai, Hapag-Lloyd, they have these services and they need ships. And so this was a ship, I don't know the length of the time charter, that Maersk took on time charter. And now then Maersk, as the time charterer of the ship, in order to pay the hire, it's called hire, that they pay, it pays up the chain under the time charter, H-I-R-E, it needs cargo. And it has a marketing division, and they go out and find cargoes. So all Walmart or whatever, or whoever it is, will say, okay, I've got 10 boxes, 10 containers that to load in Baltimore for Sri Lanka or Japan, wherever the ultimate destination was. And Maersk says, yeah, have them here by a certain day, and we'll put them on the ship. So, and those containers don't have to be Maersk. The customers, the shippers, the people who are shipping the cargo out, not carrying it, shipping it out, they can get a container from anybody. And that, again, depends on a whole web of contractual arrangements. It may be a Maersk container. It may say something else, but it doesn't matter so much to Maersk. Yeah. But then there are other people, for example, Maersk and the other large operators or time charterers, people have these liner services, they will charter space on a ship or with each other so that Maersk can book a cargo on a ONE ship. This is just for example, they have a contractual relation, and ONE can book a cargo on a Maersk ship. So it makes it more efficient, because you don't have to wait around for your ship to get into town. And so that can be done on another type of charter, either by a number of slots. They'll obligate themselves to take, okay, I'm obligated every time your ship calls Baltimore to provide you with X number of containers, or space, which amounts to the same thing. I don't know, but there could well be additional sub-charterers, they're then called, of Maersk.
So I should never assume just because I see Maersk painted on the side of a ship that Maersk necessarily owns the ship. Just like with aircraft leasing, oftentimes the airline name painted on the sides of the airplane, that airline doesn't necessarily own that jet.
Same That's a good analogy. And in the container ships, I don't know. There's some, Maersk would own some for sure. MSC would own some. Hyundai would own some. But they cannot operate. I'm not a businessman, but I don't think they could operate these global services with ships just of their own. So they depend on other ships and other ship owners. And their other ship owners are quite happy to do that. Yeah, I know how to crew and build and maintain a ship. But I don't have all these contacts, you know, with Walmart or Costco or whoever you need to have contacts with to carry this cargo. But you do, so fine, here. You pay me a certain amount per month for the ship, and my crew will take it wherever you want it to go.
So along the lines of our listening audience, primarily mediators and arbitrators, a lot of them with insurance experience, maybe not necessarily maritime, which I know is highly specialized, but just talking about damages and who potentially could be on the hook for what, just kind of wanted to go down a little list here of things that I've written and just ask your opinion on this. So after we all saw the bridge collapse in such a spectacular way, and then I think within a day or two of this happening, President Biden gets on the news, announces that the federal government will pick up the tab for rebuilding the cost of the bridge and all that. Obviously, it was a federal interstate that was traveling over the bridge, so I assume it's federal government's responsibility to maintain the bridge. Is anybody or any insurers on the hook for the costs of the damage to the bridge? Will the federal government pay to rebuild the bridge and then go after various insurers for some sort of restitution? How does that work?
A high level, yes, on those assumptions. But I recently read a report from the American Institute of Marine Underwriters that says the bridge is a Maryland entity, okay, and it itself is insured. And here, I think it's important for everyone to remember there's what we've been talking about so far is third-party insurance. It's right. The liability insurance you carry on your car. As opposed to collision, if you just single-handedly run it off into a ditch. But everybody, this was the interesting issue. If leaving aside the tragic deaths of the six workers and the two that were injured, yep. And it's just an astonishing piece of fortune that there weren't more personal injuries or deaths.
If it had happened during the middle of the day, it would have been far worse, obviously.
If state of Maryland has first-party insurance, mm-hmm. and the terms of that policy don't know what it would look like, but basically it's the insurance like you'd have on your house or whatever. If they have insurance and haven't just put it at the risk of their treasury, then insurance, first off, will pay a sizable chunk of that. Now, you know, I guess Maryland and the federal government have some sort of relationship as far as funding and pre-funding and sorting that all out. But if to the extent that the Maryland is the property owner and does have insurance, then it becomes a dispute between the first party insurer and the third party insurer.
It would be a subrogation case.
It would be a subrogation case, which I think most of your listeners would be familiar with. So you'd have relatively experienced law firms on both sides. And yes, the numbers have three or six more zeros than usual behind them, but it's there.
Now, arbitration, though, is a creature of contract, right? So would those subrogation cases necessarily go to arbitration, or if there isn't some sort of existing agreement between the first party carrier and the third party carrier, it would not be something that would end up in arbitration necessarily?
I think those would be litigation. I mean, for example, the owner, I think on Monday, filed what's called a limitation of liability action in federal court in Baltimore. And that's basically, in addition to the attempting to limit its liability under the statute and the law, but the real practical procedural purpose, whatever becomes of the limitation action, is to have all claimants present their claims in one court before one judge in one proceeding. It's very analogous. Some of your listeners may be familiar with bankruptcy law. It's analogous to saying, here I am, I'm establishing this fund, so they have put security in court, or about to, or at least according to the filing, $43 million, I believe it is. And here we think we're entitled to limit our liability to it. The judge will decide to that amount. The judge will decide whether we are or not. But in the meantime, here's security for the claim. You have to come make your claim here. Now, right. This is such a localized incident, not so bad. I mean, when I was involved in the Costa Concordia, and we have people from all over the world, so we're just trying to deal with all that. But here, it'll all be in federal court. The chief judge took the case, I noticed. He looks like an experienced judge. And in the end, once apart from the workers, and to the extent there is first-party insurance among all the claimants, right. It's going to be a dispute between insurers, in my view.
And then,
the workers themselves, they will be getting, I'm assuming, their employer has workers' comp. That's probably state workers' comp. And so they'll be getting benefits relatively soon based on any compensation scheme I've encountered. And then that compensation carrier for the six deaths, it'll be an established sum. We'll have a lien, though, on any recovery that they would make from the tortfeasor.
Among the first party carriers, there's a couple of different damages that I've noticed that, and let's see who would kind of cover what. So you've got damage to the boat, and so the vessel itself has insurance.
Hull insurance, and
the equivalent of collision in auto, we call it hull.
Right. Insurance. You're insuring the value of the thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Boat's correct. Damaged. Okay. And then it looked like a number of the cargo containers have been damaged. I don't know if any of them fell off the boat, but I can clearly see some of them are pretty smashed by the bridge.
And my understanding, based on the press reports, is that some did. I'm assuming they've been confined, if not collected, to the extent that is true that some fell off. But to the extent that there are clearly some damaged on the bow of the ship. And so, again, the owners of the cargo in that container, they will have first party insurance, and that's called cargo insurance. And those owners of the damaged cargo will get paid just in the normal course. And then that cargo insurer will become subrogated against the owner and the P&I club.
Okay. Then along the lines, going down the list here, you briefly touched on wrongful death claims for the deaths of the workers in the bridge. Obviously, they're not in an arbitration agreement with the shipping company or the vessel, so that'll be litigated in court. But right. The P&I club will basically cover to the extent what's paid out on those.
Subject to the terms of the policy, but those in the normal course, that type of injury, the collision, in maritime law, it's called an allision. Because a moving object hit a stationary object. Collision is when two moving things hit each other. Yep. But yes, so all other things being equal, those would be claims that the P&I club would indemnify the owner for.
Now you're going to have additional claims for shipping delays and damaged goods. So you're going to have shipping delays relating obviously to the cargo that's stuck on the ship, which can't move. But in addition to that, my understanding is the ship is in such a position and the bridge fell in such a way that although they're working right now very quickly to remove the bridge and open up the shipping channel, there were ships trapped in the harbor that couldn't leave.
Yes.
And so there may be, I don't know if there's items in the cargo containers that are perishable and are worthless now because they weren't able to get to their destination and whatnot. Those will be first party claims filed with the insurance carriers on those ships that are stuck, and then it'll be turned into a subrogation case against the ship that caused the accident. Is it as straightforward as that?
I think that's right. I mean, take the simplest one would be a perishable cargo, which is clearly, but I mean, those ships should have electricity. What's not, it hasn't been clear to me how much electricity power is on the dolly, but I did read something that there were reefer containers on the dolly. So if they can keep them refrigerated, but at some point the tomatoes or whatever,
gonna spoil.
You know, whatever refrigerated. So yes, let me back up one more thing. Just going back to the containers on the ship, the containers themselves are property and they're not owned rarely, if ever, be owned by the owner of the cargo in the containers. So that's another insurer that's going to have a potentially have, at least for the ones that are destroyed or damaged. That insurer will have to pay and then have a subrogated claim as well. So as to the containers on the other ships that are trapped in the harbor, can't get out, they will have contractual arrangements with that ship owner or charterer, like a Maersk or whatever. There'll be a contractual arrangement.
Yeah.
And typically that's a bill of lading. And depending on whose ship it is and what the bill of lading provides, that will be a contractual dispute as to whether if there's damage, is it the ship owner's fault under that or the carrier's fault under that contract on that ship in this circumstance, or is it beyond that carrier's control? So that would be the issue there. The other issue is the costs of on carriage to the extent that they can get them off the ship that's trapped and get them on a truck to get them to another port.
That's expensive. Someone's going to have to pay for that. Yeah.
Somebody's going to have to pay for that. But that would arise then under whatever the terms and event and tribunal that's competent to solve that problem. And that could be an arbitration. That could well be an arbitration. And so when you look at all those number of containers, each one of those containers is subject to a contract. So you can just multiply the number of contracts. Okay, there may be 10 containers for one contract, but in principle, there's a contract for every one of those containers just on the dolly.
Yep.
So look at all the containers on the other ship, and some of them are bulk cargoes. I think some of them are ro-ro. So those will all be, have to be sorted out.
What, just relating to the business interruption claims and the closure of the port, we briefly talked about a couple of cases in our conversation last week between us. Does Robbins Dry Dock and Repair Company or Kinsman Transit apply to either of these situations? And if they do, can you just very quickly summarize what those cases were about?
Right. The issue is sometimes posed as a cause of action for negligent interference with a contract. In other words, what Robbins Dry Dock says is, and then as it's been interpreted and brought forth over the years, I think it was in the 20s, but it was Justice Holmes, and is that unless you have a proprietary interest in the item that is damaged by a tortfeasor, you cannot recover economic losses. And the idea is, and it's been, scholars and Prosser and Keaton, all these people have tried to and have articulated an explanation, but it comes down to the advantages of bright line rule. Otherwise, the consequences of such an incident as this could extend, the economic consequences could extend just, ad infinitum almost. So traditionally, under Robbins Dry Dock, Kinsman Transit, I believe the Fourth Circuit case, which I found, and just refreshing my recollection on Robbins Dry Dock, is good law, Marine Navigation Sulfur versus Lone Star Industries, 1981 case from the Fourth Circuit, where they reaffirmed Robbins Dry Dock. I think Maryland would be in the Fourth Circuit. But yeah, that's the idea that, for example, then the people would say, oh, I have to go 100 miles, whereas used to I just go across the bridge, and that's an additional expense. And some of you should have known, if you're operating a ship that goes under a bridge, that you're going to have all of these. You just couldn't insure that.
Right.
And so anyway, that's the decision the cases to date, as I understand them, have taken. If pollution were involved, by statute, Congress has said third parties can recover certain economic losses.
What about the state of Maryland, in the sense that I heard their legislature is either voting on or has already voted to pass some sort of funding bill to provide lost wage income to port workers that are going to be impacted by this until the port can fully reopen? Do they necessarily have a proprietary interest? Would they be subject to some sort of payment, or does Robbins Dry Dock say no because they're not necessarily, don't necessarily have a proprietary interest in the cargo, in the ships, things like
bridge,
that.
I'd have to see the statute. But yeah, to me, these economic losses of third parties who didn't have a thing that was damaged, the employer of the 8 workers, he lost trucks and jackhammers and whatnot. Whatever the economic consequences are of the loss of those items, that's okay. He had a proprietary interest in those items that were damaged by the tortfeasor.
But it limits people, like, just let's say I live in Baltimore and I have to now drive 25 miles further to commute to my job. And so I can't file a claim that says, hey, because of this bridge collapse that you caused, now I have to spend 30 extra minutes in the car and need to purchase 25 extra miles worth of fuel every day. It stops those types of claims, or else we just go on infinite.
That's the rationale behind, as I understand it, behind Robbins Dry Dock. I wouldn't want to opine, but all I can say is that my understanding of Robbins Dry Dock is that such claims would be precluded. And not only Robbins Dry Dock, but the case, similar claims have been made in the subsequent cases, and the courts have precluded them. Now, the legislature can react to, lawyers can be creative, so I don't know.
Probably something we should have maybe discussed at the beginning of our conversation here, because it relates more to that. But a lot of people are talking about the RMS Titanic statute from 1851. Can you briefly discuss that and its implication here?
Yes. In the 1850s, the U.S. and England, Britain, were in a competition for the seas and merchant shipping on the seas. And as I understand it, as the way the law had developed in England is that they had this right. English ship owners had the right to limit their liability to the value of the ship at the time of the casualty. And U.S. ship owners did not. And so it was remedied by statute in 1851. The rationale was to keep the U.S. competitive with England and Great Britain in trying to be the master of the commercial seas. And it does, at that point, there might have been one or two P&I clubs in existence, but at that point, the ship owners were taking the risk. And you have to realize, too, there's sailing ships. I mean, you hired the best master, and you didn't hear from the ship for 3 months. And that was the rationale behind it. It's been tweaked a little bit. There's a provision now for in the case of personal injury, if the original fund is not enough, you get a little more money for personal injury cases. But the key is, in these cases, you need to establish the cause. What caused the incident? And then once you know what, or at least you make a determination, you may not ever really know, or I guess it could be several things. That is often the case. Then is that a cause of which the owner, again, thinking back to the analogy where the owner shakes hands with the master, wishes him luck, says, hope to hear from you again, had knowledge or privity of at the time the ship set sail. And so that's the key. If the owner and the cases have said, it's got to be higher than the master. And so, again, that's the law. And a lot of it's often invoked. Anybody, any of your listeners or anyone interested can read the cases to see how often the limitation is allowed or not allowed. But from an initial practical point of view, the advantage, whatever else happens, is that you get all the cases in one court.
Yep.
Does that answer the question?
No. It answers the question. So for our listening audience that are probably wondering, will this increase my ADR business? Let's just briefly touch on kind of what might go to arbitration and what won't. So you have your first party claims, third party claims, insurance coverage issues. I take it there'll be insurance bad faith issues, obviously the wrongful death situation. Some of this is obviously going to be in court. Some of this is going to be subject to arbitration. I can imagine issues with your own first party carrier are going to be covered by arbitration. Is that probably an accurate statement?
I think that's fair, or a selected forum in your policy. Your cargo insurance policy may say any claim arising here under are subject to arbitration in XYZ or in Southern District of New York or, you know, wherever. And so out of all these containers, when you look at the containers on the Dolly and the containers on the other ships, I would have to believe there are some of those contracts are subject to arbitration, not vis-a-vis the actual tortfeasor, but the cargo insurer, and then that bill of lading contract with the given ship will be subject to some sort of dispute resolution clause. And some set of those will be arbitration clauses. And as to the time charter and the slot or space charters that I mentioned are all also likely subject to, or will have arbitration agreements.
Now, I might be entirely making this up, and this is my not completely being an expert in this area, but between insurance carriers relating to subrogation, do some carriers have existing contracts between each other that would have an arbitration clause in it, or is that mostly likely going to end up in court?
I think that would most likely going to end up in court. Typically, they wouldn't. It's a good question. There is something called the inter-club agreement. Well, we didn't talk about that. The charterers, in this case, the time charterer, depending on their risk appetite, may also take out insurance. And so if it's a cargo damage claim, and if that charter, the time charter here, we'll just keep it simple, has what's called the inter-club agreement, then there would be also a regime for resolving that case based on fault. But the time charter most definitely has an arbitration agreement. Any space and slot charters have an arbitration agreement. And I read a report about fuel being a possible cause, so that those bunker supply contracts typically have arbitration agreements. I don't know where the ship got its fuel, or if it loaded fuel in Baltimore, but there are a lot of fail safes too on board a ship to make sure that the fuel is tested before it's ever put into the engine. Mm-hmm. But things do happen.
No, I've got to ask, because you're a member of a number of arbitration organizations, for items that do go to arbitration, is it typically just the big domestic U.S. providers like AAA and JAMS, or are there highly specialized arbitration associations related to maritime arbitration that are likely to be written into a lot of these arbitration provisions and contracts, so it wouldn't necessarily go to a AAA or a JAMS?
I think that's fair. I think the Society of Maritime Arbitrators in New York, especially since a lot of this, much of this cargo was loaded in the US, will definitely have some London. I don't know what the main time charter is, if that's London, or given that the owner was in Singapore, could be Singapore. I mean, basically, London is the center for maritime arbitrations, just on math. I mean, the numbers of cases, but Singapore and New York are holding their own. And so again, given that this is, I don't know who the time charter is. It's Maersk out of Copenhagen, probably Maersk out of Copenhagen, not a branch office direct with the Singaporean owner. That would be an arbitration. So there may be some sales contracts that are also affected when you start trying to think of all the contracts involved. So every cargo that's in a container, whether it's on a trap ship or on the ship on the dolly, there's an underlying sales contract, and those people are not getting their goods when they thought they were getting. And so the sales contracts are very often subject to AAA arbitration. So
Then some of
there
the
will be that.
international providers like UNCITRAL or ICC or any of those potentially. I'm just thinking because shipping is a global commerce business. So you'd imagine a lot of the other international providers would maybe possibly be involved, but you know better than me. So I'm asking you.
Yeah, I would be surprised, but I can't rule it out. If any of the main contracts, the contract between the owner and the Maersk and any of the slot or space charters or any of the bills of lading would be ICC or a trial. Again, some of the sales contracts, depending on the scope and size, the underlying sales contracts might well be ICC for sure, or AAA, I mean, even more likely. Or I would be surprised if any of the main contracts are outside to London, Singapore, or New York.
In order to kind of move the many cases that are going to be filed along for the sake of efficiency, do courts typically order parties to kind of pool things together and try to work out some sort of a global settlement, bring in an outside mediator, try to shave off some of the cases? Because, I mean, as you know, people are saying this is going to be held up in court, various parts of this, for years, and that's not an efficient way to resolve disputes. We're in the ADR business, and is that something you could see, or is this just going to continue on for a long time with a lot of individual cases?
I think we might be surprised that it does not, but I think if I were a betting person, it's going to take time. The numbers are just too big for people to make decisive decisions, if you were, until they have a better understanding of the facts and just the collecting the facts and the expenses,
Right.
the salvage operation and everything. It's going to be a
This
little.
is the benefit of the P&I Club in the sense that if we're talking about $3 billion in total damages that have to be spread among four or five insurance companies, that's tough, right, for those insurance companies. But if you're saying that's $3 billion potentially spread over 80 different insurance companies, you know, it seems like the blow is a lot less on an individual
And
basis.
some of the above the 100 million, some of the insurers, they're going to have three or four parts of this thing. It's going to be Chubb or AXA or whatever. But I do think that, I mean, what I've read and my own experience, the insurance industry can handle it. Well, one would hope after 9/11 and hurricanes and whatnot that terminals and businesses that were affected do have business interruption insurance. That's a type of first party insurance. And now their insurer may not end up having any subrogation rights, but at least those people will get some comfort and possibly share with their employees to the extent they have a business interruption claim. But going back, I think one of the questions, so 9/11 and Deepwater Horizon, special masters were appointed, I think, in both those cases. And then those claims can be subbed out to mediators and certainly to mediators. So I think they'll just notionally there have to be whatever the universe of claims subject to arbitration are, the universe of claims subject to mediation. I mean, the world's just had a lot of claims dumped on it, and they're going to have to be resolved, and mediators can help do that.
Well, this has been super fascinating. Before we go, I just want to ask you, and you can probably do a couple plugs for your own organizations. How can mediators and arbitrators learn more about maritime law? What resources would you recommend for them?
Well, the SMA, the Organization Society of Maritime Arbitrators, just finished or is maybe finishing Friday. It does an annual course on online now, maritime arbitration. It would be a great start. And anybody who's a AAA arbitrator is the AAA course after all these years is in, dealing with the SMA, both in private practice and arbitration. And it's good. There's a lot of similarities. Yep. The SMA arbitrations aren't administered, whereas the AAA arbitrations are. But maritime law, there are seminars. If you want to go back to school, you go to my alma mater, Tulane Law School, and get an LLM. Professor Davies would be happy to see you. Tulane just finished up the Admiralty Law Institute, 2.5 days of people speaking from various jurisdictions. So the opportunities are there. I pay attention to Tulane Admiralty Law. If you're a lawyer and you're not a member of the Maritime Law Association of the U.S., I would recommend that because we have a arbitration and ADR committee of the MLA.
Yep.
So that would be an excellent opportunity to join and network because it's all that committee is all lawyers and people handling claims and arbitrating.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much, Leroy, for joining me for the hour and discussing all the intricacies of this very complicated case. Maritime law is very fascinating and very vast, and I appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you, and thank you, the AAA and the ABA.
Thank you for joining us on Resolutions. Today's episode has illuminated the powerful impact of effective dispute resolution and showcased the incredible individuals who dedicate themselves to this important work. Our mission is to explore the diverse world of dispute resolution, and we hope we've inspired you to engage with conflict and collaboration in new ways. If you're not yet a member of the ABA section of dispute resolution, we invite you to join our community of professionals making a difference. Your involvement can help us build a more harmonious society together. And if you found value in our conversations, please consider leaving us a review and a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts. Your feedback helps us reach more people and continue our journey towards excellence in dispute resolution. Until next time, keep solving problems, building bridges, and creating positive changes in your communities.